I could do a little precy on what my investment, like why I was reading this to begin with. I mean, in terms of the like subtitle of my book, I'm thinking of style in terms of thinking slash writing. And that's what I'm calling it right now, is thinking writing, because I kind of don't want to choose the material instantiation or the sort of mental thing. When I'm talking about style in my book, I'm not, and the style of thinking, right? That's a phrase that I use a lot. And, right. But I am, what I'm not concerned with there is the mental process that went in the mind of Deleuze, or the mental process in the mind of Derrida, or I'm not. But when I say style of thinking, I'm not, I don't mean that. I mean the style of thinking in the writing, right? Like it's, right. So it is thinking slash writing. And actually Heidegger does give me ways of saying, here's one of the things that thinking is not. It's not just a mental operation that occurs in your head that secondarily gets instantiated in language, right? Because for him, there's no thinking without language, right? The thinking, or the way that I like to take it is thinking only operates in relation with some practice. It doesn't, there is no such thing as just thinking. There is thinking in language, thinking in writing, thinking in sound, thinking in images, you know, like I'm fine. It doesn't really matter what the sort of so-called incarnation is, but it's not that there's thinking first and then you, right? There is, you could think in your head in words and then you could write it down. That's possible too, but there's no prior thinking that happens first and then, you know, writing or something else comes afterwards. That's what I'm trying to do. But
I mean, in the first lecture, you know, I mean, this is the quote that you're after, and only when man speaks does he think,
right.
Not the other way around, right. As metaphysics still believes.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, so that's the key starting point. And he gives me that. And like I said, I want a broader scope because it doesn't have to be like, we have to then understand language very broad, or speaking very broadly there as well. Because to me, there's no reason that we're not talking about images or music or anything else. Like thinking doesn't have a necessary purchase on, you know, sort of verbal language necessarily, right? Like, but what it right. does have is a relational. It has a fundamentally related, there's no such thing as thinking itself. There is only right. thinking with, to plug the podcast.
And everything is relational. The wood is relational, right? I mean, there's no thing in itself, an object for Heidegger, it would seem, in these first three lectures at least, right? I mean, it's like the essence of wood is its relation to either a person or to some, its malleability is its essence, basically, you know? So like,
yeah, it is that sense of essence that I was really drawn to thinking here as well, because it is such a relational notion of essence, which is precisely, you know, 180 degrees opposite of what you would think of the essence. You know, the essence is the thing that it is in and of itself. But here, I mean, because of the, you know, the very Heideggerian move to think about, you know, like any set of relations, any approach, any perspective to something is going to allow a certain disclosure and a certain withdrawal, like at the same time force a certain kind of withdrawal. And so when he's talking about essence up front, you know, part of me, you know, withdrew at that, but, you know, also kind of knew in Heideggerian fashion, you know, what counts as essence is going to get undone a bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That speaks to, every single time I encounter Heidegger, I have this same kind of reaction, which is a very negative one to what I consider his sort of bucolic and naturalist sensibilities. But I have read enough that I know that as you go through it, it's not going to stay there. And it speaks to what you just said, because when I was reading the essence stuff, I had the same reaction, which was like, oh, Jesus, the essence of the hand is like, I mean, when I hear that, I just, everything about me just goes, oh, God. But I have enough confidence that it's not going to end up being something that's located in the hand, you know. But it's nevertheless, the fact that I know that, like, obviously he is very much a thinker of movement, the passive thought, right? It's, you know, and the non-propositional dimension. And yet the particular style that is characteristic of Heidegger is one that always grates on me, always.
Yeah. It's a little self-indulgent.
He has an authoritative tone. Yeah, it's a bit self-indulgent in terms of the etymology. You know, he almost, it feels arbitrarily authoritative, you know, when he pulls out, you know, the etymology of something, like, you know, pick a word, whatever it is, and this essentially means, and then it is this, but then is always such an interesting read of that word. And then, you know, that authoritarianism, I always find.
I always think, like, you couldn't get away with this type of writing. Well, really, at any era, but particularly today. I mean, imagine trying to write in that fashion. Again, I find it interesting at times, but like, he always deconstructs his own grammar and sentences and then kind of tells you like why it's important that he says that we have still not. We're still not thinking, right? He'll like isolate little parts of his thesis and say, this is why this is. And it's like, I mean, it is interesting, but it's also very just like masturbatory in a way. Like he's like, just constantly.
You wrote that sentence, Marty. And why do we use phrases such as, and it's like, well, you used it, man. I mean, it's not like it's a quote from Aristotle, right? Like it's what is most thought provoking about our era is that we are not yet thinking. And it's like, what do we do with this? What do we do with this statement? How do we understand it? It's like, well, you just asserted it. Right? Like, it is incredibly professorial in that regard.
I actually think that is so central to what is going on here. And I mean, this is why I said that authority sort of stretches past its breaking point when he does it. Just because there is a kind of an opening up or a subjection to a difference, even if that difference seems to have been, you know, auto-generated. So like, here's a sentence, right? But now I'm going to get carried away by that sentence that, you know, isn't simply the instantiation of something that I've already thought and, you know, set forth and that I have some kind of mastery over, despite the fact that it's issue four for me, it is not simply mine. And then actually attending to the directions and relationships in it is going to propel me in different ways that I can't
foresee.
And I
get that, but man, it doesn't feel that way. Like it feel when I'm reading it, it really does feel like every pearl that drops from my mouth is worthy of even my own scrutiny.
I'm gonna quote like, myself.
Oh my God, I'm quoting myself when I say the Eric Stoltz line, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it feels experimental, like explicitly he's trying to be experimental, like, or just poetic, right? I mean, because he's clearly invested in poetry and the repetition of the central question or thesis about have we begun thinking, we're not. I mean, it's just word for word every time. And I get that it's a lecture, so maybe that's part of the function of it. But it also seems like that's a stylistic choice, you know, for publication maybe as well. Like, I want to repeat the same exact clause again and again, which is so.
It's
not
different every time.
Oh, is it? Okay.
No. Every time it repeats, it's at a different moment in this pathway and sort of, you know,
exactly.
Different parts of it are withdrawn and disclosed.
Right. But it's just, it is very foreign to at least modern or, you know, contemporary academic writing, right? Because you have a thesis and then you have to build on it and then change it in some way at the end of the piece or throughout the piece. So it's like, you can't just simply repeat yourself. But Heidegger's like, well, I'm going to do that.
He also implicitly often, and I know that this doesn't hold up, but he often seems to have this like progressive version of philosophy, which is like these people who came later couldn't figure it out, but I figured it out. Like he does always, and like the Nietzsche books are paradigmatic in this, like seeing Nietzsche as the last metaphysician because he couldn't quite get out of metaphysics. And that's positioning himself as sort of beyond Nietzsche because he recognizes something that Nietzsche didn't. And there's that, I mean, I often read that, and I read that here, right? This sort of sense of a progression of thinking that's implicit in terms of how he understands. And I know that it's not, there are really easy ways of problematizing that as we go through this, there will be, but it still feels that way. So I've never, clicked.
Well, there's
with
ego.
Heidegger.
There's definitely ego there, but there's ego in that whole German tradition. I mean, they all thought they were the best, right? I mean, even when they were talking with each other, Kant with Hegel with Schelling, they were all like, fuck you, I got the answers, you don't. Heidegger's way after all them, but he'll just dismiss Kant and Hegel like with a sentence here and there. But, like, they were great. Don't get me wrong, they were great, but they totally missed all the entire part about technology that's actually the fulcrum of a modern philosophy, you know, or whatever.
I mean, to his credit, he's like, it's because it would have been impossible for them given where they
were. That's true,
in
yeah.
History. Like, they pushed it as far as they could given where they were at.
Right. They tried.
Things had to develop. Yeah.
But that's, what do you mean to his credit? That's like ultra condescending. It's not really Hegel's fault that he wasn't as smart as I am. He was stuck in the 1970s.
The stuff about teaching, I felt, was like very resonant with your approach, John. Like, the stuff, it's sort of a dispositional pedagogy, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Teach people how to learn and how to think and like, it's basically cultivating a way of cultivating is basically right. His pedagogy. And it's like, I've heard you say some version of that several times. And I think it's so relevant to contemporary pedagogies.
Here's that line, it's on page 15 in the first lecture.
Yeah.
Teaching is even more difficult than learning. We know that, but we rarely think about it. And why is teaching more difficult than learning? Not because the teacher must have a larger store of information and have it always at the ready. Teaching is more difficult than learning because what teaching calls for is this: to let learn. The real teacher, in fact, lets nothing else be learned than learning. And I'm going to focus on this, I think, a lot, or this is, I think, probably going to be the fulcrum of my approach to this entire book, is that allowing to let, like, creating the conditions of possibility for something else to arise. And the, you know, it's not an active move, but it's also not as simply a passive move either. And that, you know, the negotiation, the allowing of oneself to be possessed but not passive is at the heart of a lot of what's going on here. And it's only that allows me to temper a lot of what sounds like his arrogance and authority. You know, he's like the activity of letting learn.
Right. Well, first of all, there's at least a very brief critique of like content-based pedagogies. So yeah. Like what teaching is not is what you would traditionally call teaching, which is like biology or whatever, where you learn stuff and then apply it to something, or you learn a system. I mean, Heidegger's method of teaching and learning is much more diffuse and ambiguous. I mean, right. It's learning.
Biology could be taught that way.
Sure, sure.
Not to be.
Right.
Neither does, you know, anything in the humanities either.
Exactly, right. But how would we characterize what does learning mean for Heidegger then? Because teaching means teaching people how to learn, but what is learning? You know, like,
well, this is where he's got that tight network of relationships, because, you know, if you want to think about thinking, then you have to go right to learning, and then learning goes right to teaching, and then right. You kind of get bounced in between those three terms.
Well, we know.
I mean, I think that's worth hashing out.
We know one thing that learning is not, and you just mentioned it, but he says, his conduct therefore often produces the impression that we properly learn nothing from him. This is the real teacher. If by learning we now suddenly understand merely the procurement of useful information. So that's one thing that for him learning is not, is the procurement of useful information, which, by the way, is content delivery. Like, that is 99% of what people understand by teaching these days and learning is I want to acquire useful information. And he's at the get-go, you know, on early pages saying that's not learning, you know.
And so here's one on learning, and he says it several times, almost verbatim or even verbatim. So this is on 8 in the first lecture. To learn means to make everything we do answer to whatever essentials address themselves to us at a given moment. And that was difficult for me to wrap my head around the first couple of times, until we brought up the example of the woodworking. And, you know, like, in the margins, I had written involvement. I was kind of waiting for him to talk about a kind of involvement, and then he dies. But learning is an involvement where one where one becomes caught up, wholly caught up in the disclosure of something else. And so what does it mean to learn woodworking? Well, I mean, he's quite explicit, you know, about it not being content delivery. It's not learning to use the tools. It's not learning tips and tricks and pieces of knowledge. It is that involvement with the woodness of the wood and, you know, being able to see the, you know, the lines or the forms that the wood allows to be possible.
See, that's right. Where it gets tricky, because it actually, and I mean, this is the problem with the hierarchization, because it's like he's just not pluralist enough. Like he really does believe there's real learning and teaching, and there's bullshit learning and, right. and teaching, right?
This is where the authenticity conversation
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's over and over. I know, again. And I hate that. And I know, I mean, I don't want to be saying that endlessly, but that's how I feel with the woodworking example. Is like there's one level on which, you know, if we go to the woodworking thing, it's the true cabinet maker. This is like on just before the stuff that we read on 14, right? A cabinet maker's apprentice, someone who is learning to build cabinets, will serve as an example. His learning is not mere practice to gain facility in the use of tools, nor does he merely gather knowledge about the customary forms of things he is to build. If he is to become a true cabinet maker, he makes himself answer and respond above all to the different kinds of wood and to the shapes slumbering within the wood. It's especially that second phrase that to wood as it enters into man's dwelling with all the hidden riches of its nature. In fact, this relatedness to wood is what maintains the whole craft. Without the relatedness, the craft will never be anything but empty, busy work. Any occupation with it will be determined exclusively by business concerns. Every handicraft, all human dealings are constantly in that danger. The writing of poetry, no more exempt than that of thinking, right? So again, I mean, it's about having a true, authentic, you know, the true cabinet maker.
Right.
And that's so, okay. I get very resistant when I read, I mean, I literally wrote "yech" in the margins of my book next to that,
yeah.
You know, because I mean, it does. It smells like that kind of like, I know the real way. Everybody else is doing it wrong. And instead of saying, look, instead of making them over, you say, here's the real way. Everyone else is doing it wrong. And by the way, that everyone else thing's doing is just another variation on the thing that I'm talking about. That seems like that second move is really, really important that he doesn't make. You know, because for him, it really is an inauthentic or it's not real learning if you don't
right.
do it in this way. And that's where, you know, and he bumps up against the problems all the time of like, well, the machine has buttons and the machine had, when he talks later about the machines, and you're just like, he just sounds stupid when he talks about technology stuff.
Yeah, right? That part was a little weak to me.
You know,
yeah, I didn't even know what he was saying. Like, what was the intervention into, I mean, I know the machine is bad or something sort of for Heidegger, but that part,
No, the machine's not bad. The technological age that allows for the machine to emerge in the way that it does is the problem.
Well, right, but like the way he articulated the distinction between machinic interactions and then the craft woodwork, it's like, what, how are you making these? I don't even understand.
Because the machine doesn't respond to the wood. The machine just cuts it in, you know, at whatever point. Right. So,
right. But
which the human could do with hand tools. It requires nothing of an industrialized machine. It has everything to do with a technological orientation to the thing.
Yeah.
So, right. You know, it doesn't matter if, you know, I'm using hand tools, it can be technologically applied to the wood, and it doesn't matter, frankly, if I'm using machines, it could become involved with the
essence. Now, see, I'm not so sure that I buy the second part of that. Like, the first part I agree with you, which is that with hand tools, one could still have a technological relationship to the wood, right? So the fact of machinery is not the thing that distinguishes. But I'm not sure that with machinery, one could have an authentic relation to the wood for Heidegger. You know what I mean?
I think so. I think so, insofar as, you know, if we're going I know we didn't read the question concerning technology, but I'll kind of bring it in just a little bit, where, you know, the major feature, the essence of technology is a revelation of truth. It isn't a aletheia or a disclosure. And what he calls sort of like, you know, technological machine techne reveals is the world as a standing reserve.
That's right. Right.
Which is a way of relating to the world, which is why the hand tools can relate to the world that kind of way. But you could imagine, and I don't know, like maybe Heidegger wouldn't buy this, but you could imagine a machinery that isn't orient, that isn't connected to the world vis-a-vis standing reserve. Right. So rather than seeing, and this is where, you know, I mean, this is where you would have to probably introduce a bit of multiplicity, but rather than look at the power saw as something that is just the bigger, better, faster version of the handsaw, you have to say the power saw reveals a different relationship to the wood that could break in this direction, could break in that direction, depending on whether or not the wood has been articulated as a extracted resource or something caught up in sort of like, you know, at the cusp of human natural affairs.
Yeah.
I mean, his issue with the machinery also is the context in which it's used, which is the factory. And it's an issue. It's a critique of exploitation of labor, right? It almost seems related in some way to the master slave like dialectic, where if the worker's only at the level of the slave doing the work, alienated from the entire production, doesn't even know necessarily how the whole product is made, is not invested in it at any moment besides, you know, with the paycheck, then he's not able to have, right, just pulling the lever again and again. You don't even have to know what the product is or what it's going to be. You just have to be able to do that one task. And I guess for Heidegger, that would be inauthentic because you're not involved with the full production of the thing. You're not invested in its actualization. Right.
Which,
I mean,
you just added like one small clause to that. I would totally buy it, which is to say that is inauthentic woodworking, right? Which is to say that the person pulling the lever over and over and over again is not involved with the wood. But that's not to say that they aren't involved. They're involved with a different, I mean, wood is part of the involvement. The wood has been prefigured into a different kind of network that discloses the relationship between all of them just a little bit differently. And, you know, so like what I have, the problem that I have with him isn't that, you know, there are that, you know, woodworking orients one to wood differently than does mass production, even though they're both being worked with wood. It's that woodworking is authentic, whereas business appropriation of wood is not authentic. They're different.
But it's totally, I mean, it to me, it resonates with a completely Platonic thinking of the simulacrum and copy, where, you know, the problem with the simulacrum is it integrates external appearance into the interiority of the notion of the model. And that's, to me, the same thing. It's like it will never be anything but business concerns. Any occupation without that relatedness to the wood itself, the craft will never be anything but empty, busy work. Any occupation will be determined exclusively by business concerns. The idea that business concerns are exterior to working with wood. And it's like, that's what you're doing. You're bringing in the exteriority of a relation to channel through your relationship to the object. And to me, that's just Plato's simulacrum copy model distinction.
Everything is potentially empty, busy work. Like, why is that? Basically the whole project in the language of authenticity seems strange to me. It's like certain things suck, like working in a factory sucks, but it's not inauthentic to me. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know why you have to evaluate the different contexts and then uphold the supposedly authentic one.
You don't have to, but I feel Heidegger consistently does. Let me say, in this context, like, this was several weeks ago. I watched this video on YouTube on a Japanese company's tuna I just got interested in tuna and how it gets manufactured, right? Like, and and I watched this. It's an 18-minute video. I'm going to send, I'll send you guys the link because it's really extraordinary. And I just never had any sense of the scale and scope of the process of eating tuna, right? Like, now I eat a lot of fresh tuna here. That's what got me interested in it. It's like, I wonder, you know, like my neighbors catch tuna and they give me chunks of tuna and I eat fresh tuna. And I'm like, I wonder how that relates to the stuff that we get in the store. And it shows you the process. And again, this is like one sort of small, not even small, but one Japanese company's. And it's from the moment of catching the fish and the incredible circuitry through which the fish go in order to arrive like on your grocery store. And the, I mean, it's, I had two simultaneous reactions in watching it. One was absolute horror at the like incredibly, I don't know, just the sheer brutality at every point in this. And it really, like, this is the Heideggerian sort of part. Like, it is absolutely so fucking violent at every step in this process. And yet its violence is very hidden. It's just like, oh, it's now just a frozen piece of meat. So, now, you know, you cut it and the worker does his, you know, cutting, and then it moves to the next layer on the really conveyor belt, right? And it's packaged in this way and it's cut in this way and all this sort of stuff, like this incredible brutality, but also the extraordinary fascination that I had with like, what a species, man. What a species that can set up a process. Like, we talk about things like mass production, but we rarely see it, right? And just to see mass production on that scale and just be like, I had no idea how extraordinarily complex, sophisticated, like these machines are built very specifically for very certain size fish that are shaped in particular ways. I mean, just the whole, all of the apparatus that goes from massive shipping boats to, you know, the instant freeze that they have to do, to the cutting up, to the packaging, to the, like all this stuff. And I'm just like, this is, it's both, it's mind blowing in its extraordinary scope. And both positively and negatively, like I really had that simultaneous reaction. And I feel like he only has the negative part. Like, there's no part of him that's just like, that's pretty incredible that this species called humans has set this up. And that you and I, the three of us who eat tuna fish, know nothing about it.
On the one hand, all technological process like that is a disclosure. Everything from the massive tuna factory to the woodworking, they're both techniques, right? Yeah. And they both disclose the world in a particular kind of way. But the mechanized one is how they disclose, right? I mean, they really are like styles of disclosure, like how, you know, even despite the fact that, you know, many of the relationships contain the same elements, right? The way that each one is configured within that relationship and the sort of subtraction of some of those elements and the addition of other elements configures the world as resource, as nothing more than resource. And that's the thing that he's balking against.
Is
the reduction of anything to extractable resource that has no other sets of relationships beyond
and
the one.
Speeding anything up for Heidegger seems like a problem too. Like, he even critiques abbreviations, like U for university. Like, somehow that kind of technologizing of language reflects on the speed of thinking or the advancement of society in a negative way. And it's like, what do you want us to do? Like, it seems like, I mean, modern society is obviously super invested in efficiency. And the reason that we all have an easy access to goods and services is because of that, technological progress. Like, the reason we can go to grocery stores and get a steak.
Get tuna fish,
get whatever, is because of that highly complex system. And, but people do value some sort of authentic relation to land and food. But the only way that you can then access that kind of lifestyle is if you already have money or means. You can't just like there's this show, Bobby Flay, you know, the cook or mm-hmm. the chef mm-hmm. and Giada. Bobby and Giada go to Italy. And it's like, and they romanticize because in Italy, you can source all of your ingredients. So mm-hmm. you can go to the farm, the farmer's market, wherever, just your neighbor and get everything and make it that day and make your pasta and your fucking whatever and get your tomatoes and all that shit. And it's like, okay, maybe a person can do that in Italy that's not rich. But the point is Bobby and Giada can do that. Right. We're both millionaires. You know, not everyone can do that in America. And it's not their fault that they're using mechanized processes to access their food or whatever. I don't know.
Well, it's incredibly expensive to be poor.
Exactly.
Right? You can be more like fastidious and discerning with your money when you have that. I can like go get the cheap ingredients because I have the time and leisure and sort of educational background and, you know, lack of other pressing concerns.
Right.
I think Heidegger would agree with you. Not that it's, you know, he wouldn't say that it's their fault. He's like, look, this is a symptom of the cultural, you know, transformation. And he
right.
doesn't,
yeah.
you know, it's not necessarily exploitation for him. Like his interest is much more ethical than it is Marxist, than it is
yeah.
political in that regard, which is just like, I mean, what you're doing is you're just, you know, what humanity tends to do is it creates this inauthentic relationship to object worlds, which is how you get objects.
Right. Right.
So, so I think the critique such as, and there is, I mean, I think there's pretty clearly a critique is really about, a Weltanschauung, right? Like it's just kind of, this is how we live now. And so, you know, that's to me, And this is the best I can do when I'm reading Heidegger oftentimes is to start thinking, well, there really isn't a good guy like that, that sort of the handy, not that there really isn't a bad guy, because there's absolutely a fucking bad guy. And that's the sort of utilitarian technologization. But that the good guy is also a version of this. So what I get out of Heidegger, you know, is that there isn't just a hand craftsman. There can't be a hand craftsman of the wood who is truly just responding to the wood. That every kind of response is differently and inauthentic and not true. That's why we're not thinking, by the way, just to not to give it away.
Like, right.
You know, we can't get there, right? We cannot get to that sort of disclosive. And that's the sort of, whether you attribute it to, historical transformation or a species-wide characteristic, that we're just not capable because everything is extracted as standing reserve, as propositions, as contents. That's just our disposition to things. Heidegger is the guy, even more than Derrida, I feel like, who's taught me about the importance of, we talked about the episode we just released on indirection and intimacy. That's his whole thing, right? His whole sort of serial indirection, which is just like, hey, we're going to try a path. We're going to see, and we can't, I mean, there's even a quote on it where it says, the question, this is on 21, the question, what is called thinking can never be answered by proposing a definition of the concept thinking and then diligently explaining what is contained in that definition. Right. Like, which would be the usual way of understanding how to answer the question, what is called thinking? Like, I feel as if, for me, at least, I learned from Heidegger more than anyone that in order to respond to a question, it's not always by answering it. Right. In the conventional sense, it is by following different trajectories that come out of it. And Heidegger, like I said, more than anyone else, just shows like, what is called thinking? Okay, well, I could just define the term and explain what I mean, but that is not, you know, there are reasons why I'm not doing that. And I mean, I think actually for podcast listeners, that's a huge point, right? Like it's a huge point to say simply answering a question is not always the most fruitful or interesting way of engaging the question. I mean, I think one gets that from the Platonic dialogues in terms of the sophists versus, you know, versus Socrates, where Socrates wants an answer, you know, mm-hmm. And the sophists want a long-winded speeches. And Socrates' aversion to this is precisely like questions are supposed to have answers, you know, and the sophists are like, that's one way of responding to questions. And, you know, and in Heidegger's case, it's the least interesting, you know, and I tend to agree.
I mean, although, you know, Socrates' desire for answers is not to, like, generally when we're talking about, like, the desire for an answer is to remedy the question.
That's right. So he's not,
It's like, you know, assuaging a wound, or like, you know, putting salve on the wound so I don't have to deal with it anymore. And, you know, Socrates' orientation to questions, which he does want answers to, or at least responses, and they need to come, you know, in pretty, like, he gives
it's
pretty
yes or tight, it's yes or no's, man. He doesn't want
yes or no.
Yeah.
Right. But the answer, the yes or the no, propels that machinery. So the function of the answer is to lead to, is to allow for the next question to be formulated.
It does not halt the inquiry. Like we've now arrived at the place. No, it just propels it to the next sort of, you know, elaboration. Right. I mean, you're certainly right about that.
When searching for definitions, you know, like what is thinking? That's not the title of the book, right? It's what he doesn't title it Was ist Denken. It's Was heißt Denken, which is a strange, it's a kind of an awkward, at least in the translation, an awkward phrasing, but it seems important, the distinction between the two, right? Because I mean, would you say that he's deferring the question of the essence of thinking throughout this book? I mean, because
there is, but like the heißt is interesting.
What is it called?
Yeah. You would like, well, it's not even just what is it called. Because often, I mean, in German, if that's how you would ask somebody's name.
Exactly. It makes German interesting in that way, because you would say, like, who are you or whatever, which just in the grammar of it suggests an essence of being. But in German, it's Wie heißt du, which is what are you called, which calls attention that it's a linguistic operation. Mm-hmm. What are you called in this language? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with the title of this book, which he doesn't talk about the language precisely in these lectures, but clearly language is the house of being and we dwell in language. All of that is classic Heidegger and points to that kind of relation, that sort of relational sensibility. It's always, I don't know if he ever uses the language of mediation, you know, in the Hegelian sense, but the language is clearly key. And thinking is an immediative force in some way, right? So,
and the other inflection of the Was heißt is that's how you would ask, like, a translation question. You'd say, like, what does it mean?
Right.
But Was heißt denken would be like, what does thinking mean? So, I mean, that's another inflection point of, instead of Was ist, you know.
Right.
And I think that you're right. Like, it is that sense of, it's not simply a question of providing a definition or an answer, and not just because he's a philosopher, right, and wants to avoid and wants to discourse more, whatever, but it is an attempt to model the movement of thinking that is the sort of, I don't know, you could call it perpetual withdrawal, or you could call it perpetual deferral, or you could call it this sort of serial production of responses. That's my preference, right, is that this sort of serial, like, we're going to try this, and then this, and then this, and then this, the series approach to thinking. But I don't know. I mean, I just think that it's important not to... my aversion there is to the idea that an answer ever is an answer. And because that's what I would always want to do, is to say, like, that content where they just provide a definition of thinking and say, here's what it is, here's our operational definition. It doesn't actually operate as ending the conversation either, right? Like, it, now pragmatically it might. People are like, okay, got it, I'm out, right? Like, I don't need anymore. But of course you do, right? You have to have that definition played out in circumstances. And then you always say, well, does it apply to this or does it apply to that? So the aversion to a definition, to me, it just like his aversion to the machines and these things need to be maybe just more deftly managed than he tends to manage them. You know,
he offers sort of a weak, like, not really an apology, but like where he says the critique of these kinds of thinking, it's more of a diagnosis than a dismissive gesture, where he says, like, in order for science to operate, it needs these categories So it's not really the fault of science that it's operating this way. And yet there is a fault there, right? Like it's not accessing the complexity or the relationality that I'm after. But so it's sort of the necessity and possibility, like binary there. Yeah. But I think you're right though. Like he doesn't, it's not that satisfying for me, at least. It feels like more of a, you know, something on the side that he's just like, well, I could foresee your critique, something like this. So this is why I'm putting it here, but I really don't mean that, you know?
Yeah. Although there's an interesting, I do think I'd be curious, particularly for you, Nate, and your inclination towards the Hegelian move. Like if he didn't hold out this notion of the true thinking and the true teaching and the true, you know, the authentic or whatever.
Yeah.
If you didn't hold out that, and by the way, I do think that in each case, those things are going to get problematized later on so that they were not as clearly the good guys as opposed to the bad guys. But to me, it actually feels a lot like Hegel in the sense of like, it is a kind of relentless, not negation in the sense, but it is a relentless, like, there's no good way out of this. There is no solution. There is no answer. But I'm setting it up as if there is. I'm setting this up as true thinking is this, and all the rest is utilitarian calculus. And where I'm going to go is to say, like, actually, that true thinking is impossible. That's why it withdraws, right? Like, given its nature's withdrawal, you can't arrive at, you're never going to get to the point where you're like, I truly thought. Like it's just not going to happen. And but you don't realize that on the front end. On the front end, you think, okay, there's some true thinking and I could possibly be a true thinker instead of a utilitarian calculator.
You're right. I mean, he does basically admit, like, even I, Heidegger, the great Heidegger, I never access true thinking. Like, and so I'm culpable in this just as anybody else is, just as the sciences are, et cetera. But the distinction, he does posit alternatives like throughout, and he'll complicate them, but there's the poetic. The poetic is often praised as a kind of
phase of his career,
panacea, basically some sort of, again, it's on the horizon, you know, but it's something that's posed as an explicit alternative to humanist categories of thinking. And the difference between that and Hegel is that Hegel never offers an alternative. Right. All you have are subject-object relations. And again, they're reductive, but you don't get out of that reductive apparatus. For Heidegger, there's at least a desire for an alternative, right? And so Hegel, like, literally just refuses to offer that. And I like that for very specific reasons, and I can see why you wouldn't like that, clearly.
Well, he kind of holds out a certain kind of hope for that alternative. I mean, when he sort of gestures toward truth, and I mean, especially aletheia as a kind of clearing, a kind of disclosure that is imbued with a multiplicity of possibilities, right? That, you know, depending on the kind of network of relations that, you know, makes this clearing and that clearing, that clearing, then, you know, it can go in a number of different directions. And in that, on the, you know, the penultimate page of the second lecture, when he's talking about the problem of one track thinking, and he's got, you know, this really particular technological way of thinking about one track thinking, I'll just read it here quickly. This is where he's basically telling this is in the, every lecture ends with this little bit called summary and transition. And it's, you can tell that, you know, he's had a conversation with his class. These are lectures that he's giving in class, and he's had a conversation with his students, and he's, you know, probably fielded a few questions, and then he's kind of like summarizing what's happened and sort of like clarifying some things that happened in the conversation and elsewhere. And this is right after he's kind of like, well, actually sandwiched in between, where he's kind of like almost chastising some of his students for getting it wrong. It's like, I never said Socrates was the only great thinker, right? Well, he was the purest thinker. Purity is different than greatness, right?
And he is really, that just as an aside, he is really careful of his terminology in ways that we aren't being right now, you know, and so it's easy to say, oh, he says this guy's better. He's like, he's not saying he's better. He's saying he's perfect. Yeah. That's different for him, but sorry.
But right before that, it's like right before that part and right after he's talking about the importance of listening, you stupid students, listen up. So here's what he's got. This is the first full paragraph on 26.
On the other hand, you will make close listening essentially easier for yourselves if you will rid yourself in time of a habit which I shall call one-track thinking.
I just so want to say that to my students. It'll be so much easier for you to understand the genius of what I am telling you if you just were stopped being one-track thinkers. But anyway.
Yeah, no arrogance there.
Yeah. Right. But he, you know, like, it sounds totally arrogant and shitty there, and then, you know, it'll get muddled here a bit. The dominion of this manner of perception is so vast today that our eyes can barely encompass it. The expression one track has been chosen on purpose because I'm careful with my terminology. We should track has to do with rails and rails with technology. We would be making matters too easy for ourselves if we simply took the view that the dominion of one-track thinking has grown out of human laziness. This one-track thinking, which is becoming ever more widespread in various shapes, is one of those unsuspected and inconspicuous forms mentioned earlier in which the essence of technology assumes dominion, because that essence wills and therefore needs absolute univocity. So it's not, you know, stupid, lazy students, you're one-track thinking because you can't do any better. It's because the essence of technology is such that it directs it's intellectual brand new engagement yeah. within, yeah, in this
it's endemic.
Sort of like sequential yeah. like orientation. But so this is kind of, you know, building off of what both you and John and Nate have been talking about, is that I think there is this sort of yearning for a kind of notion of thinking or a style of thinking that is less linear, that finds itself in this clearing that is imbued with possibilities that could be taken in a number of different directions. And part of what he balks at a technologicized version of thinking or scientific kind of thinking is almost like a Platonic, almost like that dialectical kind of thinking. Is like it could only move forward in one direction. And what he finds there is a smothering univocity.
Yeah.
And you know, immediately my allergy and reaction to that is to think that, you know, one track thinking is not one as you might think, that right. with every iteration of that serial progression is there is going to diverge in really weird ways. Mm-hmm. That the addition of something new, you know, is going to like it, that. In other words, that, you know, that linearity is not as constraining as it might seem.
I wonder right, how so. Heidegger would sound differently after performativity, you know, like if he'd had the conceptual framework of performativity. I mean, he didn't. He wasn't alive during, yeah. you know, the sort of Austin, right. Wittgenstein, whatever. But because he doesn't think, he doesn't quite go, but it does seem like, I mean, I'm with you, Nathaniel, like everything seems to want to go there. And yet he still just seems
it's
like he
sort
wants
of,
to.
It's sort of there. I mean, I find like the unconscious as a conceptual thing throughout this. I mean, non-conscious, yeah. right? Yeah. I mean, performativity is all about sort of non-conscious habitualizations of, you know, social or political or economic imperatives, right? So it's like, I see that here. I mean, clearly he doesn't have the word for it, but to me, it's like performativity is almost the bad thing, right? Or at least a version of performativity where you enact humanist categories is the bad thing.
Okay, so that's the thing, but it's like, it's for me, what I mean when I say performativity is that the enactment precedes the subject, right? Like there is the action comes first, and he's interested in, and to that extent, it can't possibly be utilitarian calculus because there would be nothing to utilitarianize,
okay, yeah.
right? Because
right.
there's
right.
no sort of subject. There is an action, and then residually the
right.
big idea of a subject, you know.
I'll push back on that a bit because yeah. you know, I think precisely his concern is the actionness of calculus preceding the subject, because it is constitutive of a particular kind of subjectivity and relatedness to the world, which is why it's not because you're lazy or because, you know, you're doing the wrong things. It's because your involvement is essentially with a calculating, you know, within, you know, the performative of calculus.
Right. But you're absolutely right. So what's being made here is subjects. That's why no one is being lazy, is because they're being made by a sort of process that trains him to think in this particular way. But what he can't do is get to the sort of serial differential responses. That's what I mean, because it's just like, well, all of that is going to be inauthentic. And even exactly. The thing that I held out the hope as being authentic is still going to end up being inauthentic. And it's like, that to me is like what is so appealing about the Nietzschean Deleuzian register, is that all you can do in the face with perpetual inauthenticity is say none of it's inauthentic, right? Like it is just a series of serial differential responses, that there's not a question of one being true thinking anymore. I mean, we're past that point, I think, historically, conceptually, of saying this is real thinking, that's not. You know,
yeah.
And he can't get there, and that's really what I meant.
It's weird.
Everything seems to be straining towards that, but it's also constrained by, and I know I'm using his kind of language, right? Like, but it's constrained by his holding on to the notion of the true and the authentic, even though that true and authentic and those essences are not going to function, you know, the way that they previously did.
It's why it seems like a conceptual regress from Nietzsche and even from Hegel, to me, at least when you think about it in those terms. Like he seems to be desiring some kind of reality that we can hold on to, or an authentic relation, whatever you want to call it, that has been made inaccessible by modernity, right? I mean, his fetishizing of the Greeks to me is part of that as well. It's like they had an authentic relation. Well, it's like, how do you know that? What, you are accessing the Greeks through thousands of years of mediation. There's no authentic relation. Even if they posed one through their texts, you know, how do you know they were living authentically, and how can you pose their way of living as a horizon of our being either?
Right. So what you have to do is say he doesn't know that, and he knows that he doesn't know that, and he is positing a differential. I mean, he is simply, you know, like that to me is the generous read, which Nathaniel has been offering so far, which Nathaniel, that's become the role that you've assumed. You're like, I'm going to do the affirmative reading for everything, which is great. I mean, it really is good.
Yeah.
It's very, very important, because otherwise we're just going to sit around and be like, this authenticity crap, you know. You know, and it reminds, at least for me, it's incredibly helpful, because it reminds me, it's like, look, you want to take this affirmation thing seriously, you got to fucking do it with Heidegger, you know, like, and I think there are good reasons for that. There are good reasons to read Heidegger as not, you know, sort of committed to this notion that there is a good alternative, but the writing sure as hell lends you there. And as much as I've read Heidegger, I still feel that way when I read it. You know, I still encounter this, like, oh yes, if we could all go live in our Schwarzwalds and like make our own cabinets, you know.
You can see why he's really attractive for certain versions of contemporary theory.
Totally.
Because the project is, at some level, he wants to accommodate difference or relations, which is basically the common goal of not only post-human that kind of discourse, but most contemporary, I mean, even deconstruction, right, is the project is accommodating or, you know, doing something with difference as opposed to reducing it or isolating categories and that sort of thing. It's just that Heidegger also imbues the whole project with a sense
nostalgia.
Nostalgia, return to something. So something that was lost and a lack of something, you know, it's like, and I get that. I mean, everybody sort of has a vague feeling of that, right? I mean, with the speed of society, with information technologies, it's like, we all feel a little bit like crazy, you know, and it would be nice to have a return to a hardness of reality.
So we made the connection to Marx before and alienated labor and means of production. And what's interesting to me is just how, in some ways, post-human Heidegger is in relationship to Marx. Because whereas Marx essentially cares about the laborers and alienated, you know, alienation, Heidegger doesn't, for all of his Dasein, I mean, like, well, actually, in virtue of his Dasein stuff, he doesn't talk about humans all that much.
No,
he talks about,
no,
like,
you're right.
Right? Like, I mean, it is from the essential term that we're always very too quick to sort of translate as man or human, you know, Dasein. You know, his concern with inauthentic relationships, frankly, has to do less to do with, like, you know, the exploitation of the human and more about the reduction of the wood to resource.
Right.
Wood is what is being violated, and it's sort of the shutting down of its capacity to relate to human involvement.
Mm-hmm.
That's why all those object-oriented guys are all Heideggerians, you know? I mean, and really, I mean, they're pretty straight Heideggerians, even though they want to position themselves as being sort of post-Heideggerian. I feel like, you know, they're pretty straight Heideggerians, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it does. I think that you're absolutely right about that. That sort of critique of humanism, you know, is powerful here. And reconciling that with the nostalgia is, I guess it's maybe a perpetual process, right? At least it is for me, because I can't get past it, or I have to return to it. And I have to start to learn to see the nostalgia as tactical, or as simply one mode of expression of
symptomatic
futurity, right?
Too.
Like it's possible to do. It's just, I find myself always having to do the work. Like even though I know in the back of my head that we're going to get to a place where, oh, that craftsman who builds the cabinet isn't a sort of superior or true or allowing the, when he uses the phrase, like what the form of the wood wants, I just go like, oh my fucking God. Like,
the terms matter. The forms slumbering within it, which would be like a multiple, like it wouldn't be a form. And this is not like Michelangelo who's like, I see what's inside of the marble and then I take everything else away to liberate it. It's like a fucking piece of wood can, you know, go in a whole lot of different ways, but it's harder to go in some ways than others because of the, you know, the flow of the grain and the hardness and whatever else.
Right. But right. I mean, it gets back to the active passive question. So let's say there are 17 ways that the wood could go, but what if I want to go the 18th way? Right. Like, I mean, that somehow I'm being a not true cabinet maker if I go way 18. And it's like, why? Why is way 18 any different than the first 17? I mean, when I'm out on the kayak, my kayak wants to go against the wind. But I don't always want to do that, right? So what my kayak wants based on, you know, aero and hydrodynamics, aerodynamics is what I was about to say.
that's actually a feature of your kayak.
you know, is like what my kayak wants is, again, one thing, but it's just one. And the idea that I am supposed to, in order to be true to the yak, I should somehow let it go where it wants. It's like that seems like just embracing passivity, right? And giving the activity to, like, okay, the activity of objects. In other words, it seems not relational at all. You know?
Yeah, but the day that I see a tree pop out a chair is the day that I'll believe that the form of the chair in the wood is a passive relationship to the
that's
tree.
That's fine. That's fair. I mean, I accept that.
Because you see the kayak is blown around, right?
Right,
and,
right.
But that's there's something very different, you know, in the relationship here. And to say, like, look, to say that the kayaking is always a sort of like a negotiating with the signs that the kayak emits in relationship to, you know, the water and the wind and everything else.
You just have to do a lot of work on the forms slumbering within phrasing. But again, I mean, I feel like what I come up against with Heidegger is I'm frequently faced with having to do a lot of work on particular locutions in order to make them not resonate with me the way that they just instinctively do repeatedly. You know,
it's also like affirmative readings don't have to preclude confrontations with the text either.
No.
You should never wholesale just be like, this is the guy, which a lot of people do with Heidegger. And it comes to the receptions and interpretations of him as the thinker of postmodernity or posthumanist scholarship. You know, it's like everybody, I just feel like there's almost equal parts progressive and regressive, conceptual and ethical, you know, figments within Heidegger's thinking. And I don't know why you can't just sort of hold those tensions. You know, it's like that almost makes him more interesting to me than just if he were just so ruthlessly progressive and deconstructionist to the point where, you know, if there was no nostalgia in Heidegger, he wouldn't be Heidegger, you know. Right. So it's like, right. Yeah.
Right. So what do you do? You have to negotiate with it.
And right.
See right. And you, and you guys are quite right.
You're slumbering within it.
Right. Right. You guys are quite right. You do have to do that with everything. I mean, for me, simply, it comes down to like, I don't know, the things that are I'm not content with simply saying Heidegger's nostalgic and that sucks, because that just is boring. It's just, you know, like, fine, I know who Heidegger is. So I'm not, I'm interested in the moments that push me out of that and make me go, oh, Heidegger is something other than who I thought he was, or his thinking does something other than what I thought. That's the thing that does it in an interesting ways to me. It's just that there are some sort of some tracks of his one track system that are so well worn and so familiar.
I mean, he's positioned often as a solution to like Cartesian thinking or humanist right. thinking, you know. But importantly for Heidegger, again, it's those errors of previous philosophers are in some ways necessary, right? It's like, or inescapable. It's kind of a Hegelian yeah. move, what he does with Descartes. It's like Descartes' errors when he frames the cogito are not only a product of his circumstances, but are a product of thinking. It's right. like the withdrawal of thinking, that's what produces Descartes, and it in some ways produces all of us, produces Heidegger. So you don't just get to simply discard Descartes and now we're Heidegger.
That's right.
You still have a little bit of Descartes. I mean, again, it's unfortunate perhaps, and it has consequences to think that way, but well, you don't just, yeah.
Encountering any kind of otherness means a challenge, right? Like, right. I mean, interacting with you guys, no less so, right? I mean, we have an idiom that's familiar, but we have our distinctions, and it's always that. And I guess to some level, you're really just sort of saying, which are the challenges that sort of that interest me the most or provoke for me the most, you know? And for me, at least, the nostalgic one, which I just hear a lot. I mean, I hear everywhere, right? Even for people that aren't Heideggerians, you know, things.
I'm wondering if there, how else you would treat the nostalgia? Because my initial like way of dealing with it would be the kind of Zizek way, where you just treat it as a symptom of a desire for right. truth or for, right. right. But that to me is kind of a well-worn territory at this out. Point too, mm-hmm. right? So like, how do you manage the nostalgia without simply saying it's dumb or bad, but without also just saying like it's symptomatic of a certain, like, you know, humanist framework or whatever.
Say,
like,
yes, you could say it's the production of an artificial alternative that will be demonstrated to be artificial, but the necessity of alternatives as you progress, you know, I mean, that's just, I'm just spitballing, yeah. right? It's not yeah. like I've thought through this, but you could say like,
okay, that's a good point. Just like, how else are you going to be able to talk about right. the production of the standing reserve without sounding nostalgic? Because the relief that you're going to give it is, I mean, well, this is where I pause, because, you know, you've been using the language of challenging, and obviously very important in there, given the specific way in which challenging matters for Heidegger's critique.
Challenging forth.
Right, yeah, to that to issue forth a challenging that configures or transforms, you know, the natural world into extractable resource.
That's right.
But, you know, if the chair is slumbering in the tree and I'm going to use some hand planes and hatchets and shit to bring it out, man, that sleeping chair got challenged, right? Yeah. And that's
Wake
where
the fuck
I have
up, Mr. Chair.
I know. Time to enter a new horizon, right?
Come out of your liminal space, Mr. Socko. It's time for you to dance.
Yeah, talk. I mean, like, it's one thing to, you know, take the sock off.
Right,
it's a challenge to put the sock on, right?
Yeah. It's like, no, let me go back to my slumber.
Because I do a decent amount of woodwork, and You know, just because of the sort of the setup.
He's a Heideggerian. Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, proper Heideggerian.
The
wow.
true relation to the planing and the.
Well, that's exactly what I want to challenge a bit. It's because, you know, like I grew up doing woodworking mostly with power tools, and I had one kind of relationship to it. And because of where I live now, mostly because I have to do my work predominantly in a basement that I can't stand up in, that's not super well ventilated, I've shifted more to hand tools because, you know, I want to limit the amount of sawdust that I'm throwing up in the air.
Right.
And you know, I've like, and what I've realized is just one, how intertwined that is with the woodworking that I'm used to, and also how different it is as well. And, you know, watching various videos of, you know, people that are not purists, right? They'll like predominantly do hand tools, but they have no problem going to use, mm-hmm. you know, the power tool here and there. And, it has allowed me to relate seriously to the wood differently. Right. And there is part of me that wants to say I'm more authentically related to the wood mm-hmm. as wood, because I'm actually thinking of it as wood and in terms of its grain. And, you know, I transformed a piece of firewood into a mallet, right? With hand tools, and not because I wanted to find a nostalgic, you know, authentic mm-hmm. relationship to the wood. It's because I didn't have a whole lot of disposable money to throw into this. I had a bunch of firewood that I didn't need, and, you know, we were in the middle of a lockdown, and I needed to just mm-hmm. like bane away at something. Mm-hmm. And like I learned shit about that wood that I never would have learned if I would have just run it through, you know,
I don't doubt that at all.
Not saying that that's more authentic.
Yeah, it's different.
Right. I don't want to say, yeah, it is different. It produced a different relationship to the wood.
But that is completely unsurprising to me, right? Like a different techno mediation is going to produce a different kind of relation, like
wood.
Of course it would. Yeah, and a different product and a different subject, right? Like, I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever. There's a huge difference between that and saying one is true and genuine,
yeah,
and the other is standing reserve and authentic, et cetera. You know, like that. Well,
it's like putting on a different mask. I mean, like my relationship to handiwork is fairly minimal, but when I do it, like I did construction for a summer and I'll occasionally put, you know, a fucking table together or something. But like because I'm usually embroiled in academic work or like super technical, like, you know, doing music and it's all online and it's all with the computer. When I do something that's like sort of real, you know, in that sense, it's satisfying because it's so different from what I usually do. It's like I'm putting on the mask of a construction worker for a week or two. And it's like, this is a nice little game that I'm playing. And it's like, I get to pretend to be something that I'm usually not, you know? So it's like, it's very performative in that sense. And also pretty annoying when you put it this way. It's like, I'm pretending to be, it's like, it's nice to pretend to be a construction worker because I'm not a construction worker. And being a construction worker all the time would probably suck.
Right.
But flip
that around. Someone like me who doesn't make anything and doesn't do anything, when I'm capable of doing something online, like whether it's the editing of the things, I feel that way about right. the sort of, oh man, I managed a technological feat and I am a master of the, you know, like,
yeah.
Truthfully, like it's kind of the tinkering relation. It's even less about what the tools are than your relation or your familiarity or your comfort level with those kinds of those tools or those apparatuses, you know, I suspect. Right. But mm-hmm. what I'm doing is just sort of trying to flatten it out, right? Where it's just like, look, of course, for those of us who don't do one, doing the other has a sense of satisfaction and accomplishing something has right. a sense of both frustration and satisfaction. You know what I mean?
The position and intensity of something like a telos matters quite a bit in here, where, you know, with the kind of hand woodworking that sure. I was, you know, doing, that, you know, the telos was really open-ended and I was able to really, you know, I was still like following steps and had, you know, like I was still making a hammer.
Yeah, you weren't making a chair. You were making a hammer, right?
But I also was more invested in the thing as a kind of experiment of trying to see like what was going to happen over the course of the production of this thing. Mm-hmm. But right now I'm building an office and I'm using far fewer hand tools because I want a motherfucking functional office that I don't have until, you know, like right. October to get it done so that I can experience, you know, the grains of every pine fiber as I'm making the thing, like,
right. And I get that the difference in the relationship. I mean, I think this in terms of thinking sometimes. So for me, I mean, and this is certainly too much information, but like one of the thoughts that can be deeply disturbing to me is the thought of space, like outer space. Like I can't watch certain movies because they're in space because, I'm aware of this, that on one level I can think about the Earth and the galaxy and it doesn't bother me. Like it's nothing. It's just like, okay, it's a little model that I picture in my head. On the other hand, I can feel the sort of spatial insignificance of Earth and me and whatever. And it's absolutely genuinely panic attack inducing. And so I understand there are different relationships to thinking in those two scenarios. One that treats it as, like I said, like a model of a standing reserve of an idea of a galaxy or solar system or whatever else that is completely capable of functioning with that. The other is sort of feelings one's position in relationship to it, and it's terrifying. And I have often, recently especially, the last few years, thought that my relationship to thinking about space and the terror that it induces in me is probably a lot like other people's relationship to thinking about like gay marriage.
God.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
No, but I mean, just like that it induces this intense sense of panic. And that's where this question of the relationship to thinking is like hugely, hugely important. And the differences between ways that facilitate, I don't know, like total panic inducing versus ways it could facilitate like completely functional, not a problem. You know, I truly train myself. It's like when I know when those thoughts start hitting me, often it would happen at the dog park for some reason. I would just be thinking about space for some reason at the dog park. But I have to train myself to think in terms of the model so that I can like literally like stand sometimes. You know, and it's to become functional requires a certain relationship of thinking, you know, which is instrumental in a way and in a kind of distanced relationship. So, I mean, I see value in both of those things, figuring out like the relative ratios. And of course, most people don't have that relationship to space. They love fucking space movies. And it's, so it's going to be different for different bodies, you know. That scares the shit out of me. But whatever. I mean, the point is
literally because you need something to orient yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and
everybody
and
does.
You're not a navigator, so those stars aren't doing anything for you.
Right. I don't know how to deal with the stars. But it really, I mean, to me, what's interesting about it is it's in some ways the same thought, but a different relation to that same thought, right? And I think that that's one of the things that he's after here is a thinking that's more along the lines of the panic inducing, you know, because right. it's not just a thought, it's not a content that one gains possession of. I mean, there's, you know, he's going to have much better terms for thinking of it than I do, but nevertheless, like, and I get it. I get the difference. I get the distinction, and I get its importance to make the distinction. Not all thinking of space is the same experience or the same thing or whatever. But you don't have to say one's true and one's, or one's authentic and one's genuine and all of the terminology that comes along with that, that leads one to be like, oh yes, back in the good old days when we would really understand the grain of the wood.
It seems like what Heidegger is saying is that thinking only happens in the making molecular of the molar. So you have sort of like the apparent false unity of things, and thinking is always the sort of the getting within those sets of relationships that give the false appearance of the molar and then starts to move through them. But you always have to recognize that the molar itself, you know, the thing that appears to be the
the coherent entity that, you know, let's call it the propositional statement, or right. let's call it Earth, or let's call it the galaxy, right. whatever else, whatever that model is,
right.
That is inauthentic.
Right.
And one way of thinking of this is trying to, in some ways, he's missing the inventive dimension.
Well, look, the problem with that is that the very distinction of the privileging of the molecular is a molar distinction, right? Yeah. Like that's the problem. In other words, what you're missing out on is the molecularizing of the molar, you know? Right. So it's in fact, in that sense, it's the becoming molecular that's the important part, not the molecular.
Right. Yeah,
you know, right. Talk about the molecular would be a molarization.
Right.
But even there, or better yet, like the therapeutic capacity or the life-giving capacity of the molar. I mean, as you said, like
that's look, a better way of. I love that. If we were talking about this in therapeutic terms, it would make so much more sense to me. You know.
Like, yeah. I mean, it is what it sounds like is that your relationship to the panic inducing relationship space that you have is the molecularization of molar models of our position in space. And as soon as you're able to molarize that outright, then like you're okay. The grounding point.
Yep. It's containable. But when everything is in play and moving, I can't fucking think it absolutely terrifies me, right? Like,
but you brought up like gay marriage. I mean, like, what is one of our favorite, you know, sort of stupid arguments to mobilize against gay marriage? It's usually some version of the slippery slope argument. Right. Like, well, if we allow gay marriage, then, we're going to allow, cats and dogs are going to, have three-way marriages with humans and whatever else. And like,
it's the same kind of logic. So, that's what I'm saying. It's the same.
It's the same like kind of logic.
Everything's in motion.
If you destabilize the boundaries, sort of like gender expectations in relationship to, so like sexual reproduction and marriage, like the boundaries that divide human from non-human are easily put into question, and often do get importantly put into question. Right. Well, but if all of that slips away at once, I mean, dystopia. What's the vertigo? The vertigo.
Right. Vertigo.
And theory produces vertigo for a lot of people, and it actively produces discomfort. You know, when you upset those boundaries, like you were just saying, I mean, that does produce a lack of orientation. You know, your feet are not on the ground when you're theorizing, and Heidegger seems to be interested in that, but he also kind of. Like his mobilization of the poetic seems to be a way of making that vertigo again therapeutic in some way, right? It's like it's kind of an investment in the sublime, where what was terrifying actually produces like ecstasy as opposed to just terror or panic, right?
It's so interesting because I always feel like when I think of it, I always feel like I want to live right on that edge. I don't want to live in the molar comfort area, and I can't live in the sort of chaotic molecular. I like to live right on that edge that I can, you know, sort of be moved back and forth or move back and forth. But I see it. And for instance, the poetry thing is something that I've always had the same relationship to. Now, I think a lot of the reason for that is because of my occupation, right? Like I am I'm an English professor in an English department surrounded by people who believe in the wonders of poetry. And so, I am just sort of instinctively cynical about that. Like if I lived in a different place, I might have more of a investment in the poetic, but because everyone that I'm around believes in the wonders of poetry, I'm like, oh, fucking poetry, Jesus, you know? The contrarian ethos. And it is that. Like, I don't think that that's a good, bad, indifferent thing. It's just a thing. And I think it's a, you know, I mean, I'm aware of it. I know it, but it's still there. Like the fact that I recognize, you know, its history or its origins doesn't make it go away at all.
Right. I mean, the poetic is one way of relating to complexity, and Heidegger likes it, and that's fine. Yeah. But it's framing it as a panacea is odd to me. You know, it's just one way of doing things. You know, it's like you talk about just orientations. It's just so one among others.
It's one of the things where, like, I wonder about this sometimes. So should philosophers do more things. Like, for instance, the story I just told about my relationship to space. If I fancied myself a philosopher, is that the kind of thing that I should talk? Like, look, here's a way that this body relates to questions of space. And it's not like, I'm not saying the true way of relating to space is seeing, is experiencing the constant movement of celestial bodies. It's not. It's a, you know, it's terrifying for this body. In other words, right, should there be even more sort of biographical or expressive disposition in...
There's a bit of that in Descartes' Meditations.
Right? Oh, like, Descartes' Meditations, you know, is that, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Rousseau's Confessions, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, there is... I ask this very pragmatically because there have been times where I've toyed with putting that in the book here of like chunks of like... almost biographical. I mean, I don't simply want to do a biographical, but like to have sort of biographical stuff in there of like, and it's really important that it not be simply idiosyncratic, right? That it also be sort of conceptual. But it's something that I've never done because I've always had such an aversion to.
I have trouble. Nathaniel and I talked about this, I think, on just the intro to the Deleuze cast. I have trouble not just with biographical examples, but just with examples in general. Writing something to illustrate the theory. It's like the theory is illustrating itself. Why do I have to go? And it just falls apart as soon as I try to write it, typically. I found a couple that I can do, but like it's usually a real challenge.
But illustrate is actually a good word there in the sense that it's not reflecting the theory. It is filling it out. Like it's doing something. Because to me, when I took the space example, I remember thinking right before I said that, I was like, this is going to take us in a slightly different direction. It's jumping off from the point that we're talking about. So it's not an example in the sense of the general particular. It is just a concrete instantiation from the theoretical point that will go somewhere else, right? It will be, it's not unrelated.
That's what's so hard about coming up with examples is despite the fact that I think all three of us would very quickly sort of like dismiss the very possibility of an example qua example, still kind of feel that need. You're like, all right, I need to embody the thing that I've just said rather than find something else that has a particular kind of alliance with it that will, you know, do some explanatory kind of work in taking to it, but it's also going to launch me in a different direction.
Right.
I found that because usually, at least pedagogically, examples are meant to clarify or to make to what's reify almost, you know, make something a little bit more graspable by the students. But in writing, I find that it's just so I want the example to just do something weird, like, you know, not explain anything really, or just make it even less comprehensible.
So do that. Like that's, I mean, that's exactly, in other words, there's a logic to exemplarity that's really important for the kind of work that we do, because there is a demand both from within us and from external sources of like, give us something concrete, right? That is a demand. And like, hey, okay, I'll give you something concrete and it's not going to clarify anything.